Throughout the year, we drink NC wine, cider, and mead. Whether you join us for an event, plan a visit to your local winery, cidery, or meadery, or enjoy a meal at your favorite restaurant perfectly paired with NC wine, anytime is a great time to get out and give love to your local maker. To plan your trip, download the NC Wine app or visit ncwine.org.
Hi, I'm Matt.
And I'm Joe. We're the NC Wine Guys. Welcome to Cork Talk.
In this episode, we talk with Alan Ward from St. Paul Mountain Farms in Hendersonville, North Carolina. St. Paul Mountain Farms produces wines as St. Paul Mountain Vineyards and ciders as Appalachian Ridge Hard Cider.
The conversation we had with Alan was great. He talked to us about the history of the vineyard and orchard, what it means to him to grow and produce a great product, and just how important preserving agricultural lands is in today's world.
Wine Class of the Wine Mouths is back. Join us as Jesse and Jessica talk to us about the winemaking method of Piquette. This episode is made possible thanks to two sponsors, Visit Hendersonville and the North Carolina Wine and Grape Council. You'll hear a special segment in this episode from Michelle Owens to learn more about all things Hendersonville.
So sit back, pour a glass, and listen.
All right, so we are here today with Michelle Owens of the Henderson County TDA. Michelle, thank you very much for this segment and welcome to Cork Talk.
Thank you for having me. Looking forward to it.
So Michelle, tell everyone a little bit about yourself and a little bit about why folks should come and visit Henderson County, North Carolina.
Well, I'm not the reason they should come, but I am the executive director of Henderson County TDA. And our job, we are what's known as the DMO for Henderson County and Hendersonville, North Carolina. And our job is to market the destination for visitors to come and to help support the tourism economy by bringing those heads and beds. But also, we fund things that help grow the tourism economy and work with all of our tourism partners. So it's lodging properties, attractions, restaurants, anything that would make you want to visit an area is a partner of ours, really to help the entire community and its economy. For us, wineries are a very important part of that economy. So really glad to be here.
We definitely agree that wineries in that area are absolutely important to the state, absolutely important to the area, and have a lot of good quality wine coming out of that county.
Yes, I would agree. I wouldn't say a wine expert like you guys are, but I'm definitely a wine aficionado. I have known the Hendersonville region for quite a long while. I started out as a camp counselor there, and that's really one of the things that the area has been long and best known for is its outdoor amenities and camps and things like that that are beautiful and wonderful, as well, of course, as its apple crop. But all of those things have made it, and I think will continue to make it a perfect home for the Crest of the Blue Ridge AVA and for growing and producing great wines. I tell you, I've been humbled by the people I've met working in the industry in the area and really very happily surprised when I first got there to taste and enjoy some of the wines, which I give away as Christmas gifts myself.
So we know there's some fantastic wineries and vineyards, and the scenery go with the wine is just spectacular. And the apples, of course, is a big part. But what else is there to do in Henderson County for folks that might be planning to visit and maybe talk about Hendersonville itself and things to do downtown?
Sure, absolutely. And, you know, I don't know how long you have, maybe 2 or 3 hours I could talk about this particular subject. I'll try to be a little bit more succinct than that because it really is a wonderful destination. I think one of the things that makes it unique is within a 20-minute span, you can be on top of a mountain in a rural, remote feeling area, a glass of really wonderful wine in your hands. And again, 20 minutes later, you are downtown on Main Street with your pick of shops and in Hendersonville, shops and fine restaurants and wonderful atmosphere and things to do in a really vibrant community. And then you drive another few minutes and you're on a hiking trail. So there's just such a multitude of things to see and do. The area has long been known about for the State Playhouse of North Carolina, and that revs up every year, Flat Rock Playhouse. You know, just such a wide variety of experiences and settings in a small, very welcoming area We're very fortunate. A lot of people say that we have been an undiscovered gem in Western North Carolina, and I kind of agree.
I would absolutely agree. Hendersonville is one of my favorite places to visit. Always look forward to going there. We try to make it at least once a year. Look forward to our next visit for sure. In addition to some of the things you've already talked about, are there some big events that happen in Henderson County that folks might want to know about?
Yes. Every year we have our Cider, Wine, and Dine event, and it's always in April. So be on the lookout for that. And that's really important to all of our cideries, wineries, and restaurants. And they come together and just host a series of events in April, as well as, of course, the State Apple Festival, which everybody has probably heard of at some point or another, which is on Labor Day weekend every year. And then a whole host throughout the summer. We have a summer music series that lots of different types of music events. There's a rich traditional music heritage, but also a whole music scene, if you will, that kind of comes to life in downtown Hendersonville every summer and throughout the year at a lot of our venues, including our wineries.
So, Michelle, tell us, what do you think the next 5 years looks like for tourism and attractions in Henderson County?
I think growth. I think one of the things I hope, if we're doing our job right, you know, that people will begin to discover us more and more. We are, you know, relatively close to Asheville, about 30 minutes away, but it is such a distinct and different community with its own personality and many of its own offerings. It's worthy of a visit all its own and a week all of its own. I really believe that. And I hope that more and more people will come to recognize that as a wonderful place to stay in and of its own right. What we often end up finding is a lot of people come to visit and they return to live because it's such a lovely place to be.
Wouldn't blame her for that one bit.
For sure. What's the one message that you want folks to know about coming to visit?
Really, that everyone is welcome. One of the things we hear the most when people come into our Welcome Center, which is on Main Street, is they'll come in off of the street. They're like, everyone is just so friendly. Doesn't matter who you are or where you're from or anything. And I really think that it's an authentic welcoming that this community gives to its visitors. And I think you'll find that at every place in our destination, whether it's a winery or a brewery, or a restaurant, or a park, you're going to find friendly people that want to help you and are glad you've came and want to get to know you.
Excellent. So tell folks if they're interested in planning a visit to Hendersonville and Henderson County, where might they go to find out more information?
I would highly recommend our website. It's visithendersonvillenc.org. Again, that's visithendersonvillenc.org. And that's a great launch pad for planning your trip. You can create a favorites list as you look through things and send it to yourself. We've just started our blog, so lots of new content coming there to tell you about what there is to see and do. You can order a visitor guide. We like to think of it as a great starting point and primer for all things Hendersonville and visiting Henderson County, North Carolina.
Excellent. Well, Michelle, thank you very much. This has been really great. Definitely encourage listeners to head on out to Henderson County and check out all there is to see.
Thank you.
Thanks, Michelle. So today we have the pleasure of having Alan Ward join us from St. Paul Farms, which includes St. Paul Mountain Vineyards and Appalachian Ridge Artisan Hard Cider. So Alan, welcome to Cork Talk.
Thank you. Appreciate you guys coming up and spending time with us.
We're very glad to be here. Hendersonville is always one of our favorite places to visit in the state. So we're very glad to be here today. So tell folks a little bit about St. Paul Mountain Farms and who you are.
Well, I'm Alan Ward, as you said earlier. And I grew up on this farm. We've been here for, believe it or not, 9 generations. We're a centennial farm. And my mother was a historian. She made me rub tombstones when I was a young man. So I know all about this area at a young age more than I wanted to. But as I've gotten older, I've really taken an interest in the land here. And when I started out with the vineyard, I don't know if I bought the vineyard or the vineyard bought me. So what my goal was to put back all the land in our family that I could that had been sold off. Urban sprawl is one of the worst problems you can have in a town as far as you know, environmental issues, runoff, different things. So my goal is to take what land I bought back and land I plan on buying back and put it in permanent farming, conservation easements. The reason I liked wine. I was fortunate enough to have a job, which I still have, where I get to travel around the country as well as the world. And we'll visit places, and we didn't have some dreamland. From growing up on a farm, you knew that farming was a difficult task. And we were the first people in Henderson County, or I was the first. I wish there was a we to share that, share the bills with, but it's just me and on the farming side. And we were told you couldn't grow vinifera here. And if you tell me I can't do something, it's makes me a little more interested in figuring out how you could do it. So growing apples here and traveling to Burgundy, France, which is very similar to us, not Bordeaux, but Burgundy. And with the apples going to Normandy, France, which is really the cider capital of the world, we figured out that this would be a pretty good bet, that there, we could take the chances. So when we started out, we planted probably 11 different varietals of French vinifera and a couple of French hybrids. And we've had success with the majority of those French viniferas. A lot of people want you to stick with certain things, but you know, you don't gain any ground if you do what everyone else is saying or just stick with what's safe. So we've grown things like Montepulciano, Sangiovese, I'm getting St. Paul and my sands mixed up here, as well as Cabernet Sauvignon, Cabernet Franc, Merlot, Petit Verdot. I sound like I'm Baskin Robbins here with ice cream varietals. But we tried different varietals, even things like Pinot Noir, and we'll grow at different altitudes. We have a vineyard that we lease down in Polk County that's 1,000 feet elevation, and here we go from 2,300 up to about 3,000 feet elevation. We do have an American viticulture area here called the Crest of the Blue Ridge, which in my old days, I was a chemistry and biology major. I never was a chemist or biologist, so remember very little about that except a little organic chemistry. But I do remember the biology that in this region, we have more geological diversity than anywhere in the world, And the second oldest mountain range with Appalachian Mountain Range is the second oldest in the world. So we get a lot of minerals. It's very rocky here and we've got good drainage. So it was a perfect place to grow apples and ultimately a really a great place to grow French vinifera. We're still experimenting with a lot of different varieties that I haven't mentioned. We'll get into that maybe a little later.
Oh, yeah. So, you know, talking about the land and talking about your family's land, so how much land is actually here?
There's about 50 acres that we own currently, and we're under contract for about another 50 acres. There's about 150 acres that I would love to own. We kind of feel like we're in on a demilitarized zone, because urban sprawl is just creeping in all around us.
Sure.
And we're working hard with the Conserving Carolina and other organizations, as well as the State Farm Preservation, on different programs they have that help both the farmer and the seller that's not wanting to continue to farm. So that's going to be important. We can have the AVA and all this stuff, but if we aren't able to purchase it or houses get built on it and we just become, like I say, a clutter of spits and spats of land, it's going to be a lot tougher.
Yeah.
So since we're really blessed to be this close to town and still be on a farm, and there's an area I could take you to just right across the hill here that's got a 360-degree view. And I joke when I say this, right now we don't do weddings or divorces. We just do wine. So we're not an events center per se. We're really trying to focus hard on the winemaking. And as you guys are aware of, we just built a new facility that's taken a lot longer to complete. We're 99 9/10 there. We produce, this is our second production year here at that building.
Well, you know, wine's in it for the long game. So
it is.
Nothing's quick in wine, except for finishing off the bottle. So.
Especially building the winery. So. But we're very fortunate to have the folks, our team, as we call it, or is really, I don't have employees. I have people I work with. You guys are familiar with Barbara Walker. Barbara has really built our tasting room and built our brand and our sales up. And we have very little turnover in staff, which we're very fortunate to have. We actually have a young lady, Stephanie, that helps Barbara. Her family has a vineyard in Virginia that's a smaller winery in a rural area that wouldn't support the whole family. And she and her husband, both her husband was a winemaker in North Carolina for a while. So we're very lucky to have some of the staff that we have to kind of build a team. My philosophy here and in life is you don't rent to own, you just rent, you know, in life. And we're just trying to leave this in a much better position for that next generation, the generation after that. And we're trying to educate the people that come to St. Paul Mountain Vineyards about what it takes to produce wine and to produce great wines, not just good wines. That's our goal. And we're not saying we achieve it every time. We're not going to go into awards and governor's cups. We've been fortunate enough to win four of those. But we just really constantly strive to improve. We're trying, our goal is to be around 10,000 cases to where we don't have to worry about distributing. That we're selling at the farm to local restaurants and online for folks that have visited us here. So we're really trying to keep it artisan, and we don't look at the, you obviously we look at the money because we have to be sustainable, but our goal is both, is to have that, something you'd be proud of, and the money seems to take care of itself.
So what year did you first plant the first vines?
Well, we could call that the Grapes of Wrath. I had a partner, I won't mention names because we want lawyers calling into your show, but or podcast, but I had a good friend that we planted vinifera on his property, and it just didn't work out for us, and we parted ways. Back in 2005, 6, and 7 is when we started planting, and we planted in 6 and 7. So a lot of these vines are 12 to 14 years old, if my math's correct. So, and some of them were machine planted, some of them were augered in with a tractor. But, you know, it's most of these vines are well over 10 years old. Now, each year we add to that, so let me retract my previous statement. We've got some vines that are on their third leaf, meaning it'll be the first production, some of the newer varietals that we're trying, and fourth leaf. And we found that a lot of things that people can't grow in a certain area, it's hard to get information because it's not been done here, and what grows in the mid part of the state in the Winston-Salem area where your elevations are below 1,000, but you get the cool stuff coming in from or off the Appalachian Mountain Range. It's different where we're on the escarpment where we get the what's called the thermal belt from down in Polk County. We don't get quite as cold. We're kind of like Goldilocks, we feel here. We're not too hot, not too cold. And so we're able to grow a lot of things depending on where we have the vineyard at, the elevations within our ABA in our county. So the whites grow better, like Viognier, the thinner skin grapes, Pinot Grigio, Riesling at the higher elevations. And we'll find those little niche areas. And we don't just grow what's easy. A lot of folks want to grow what's easy, but you know, there's a give and take there. If you're producing a product and you're, I don't know if you guys are not as old as I am, but Neapolitan ice cream where you had strawberry, chocolate, and vanilla. We're not Neapolitan.
I never really liked that. I liked my vanilla. I liked my chocolate. I liked my strawberry, but not together.
Yeah. But you also like probably butter pecan and peppermint.
Yeah.
So we try and find some varietals that a gentleman that you probably know well, Ian Taplin, he'll take us to the West Coast, and we're not trying to be like Napa. The only thing they grow out there, from my perspective, is cab. I didn't even want to ride in a cab, much less taste any more Cabernet Sauvignon. But we've been able to grow that here. Ian gave us a compliment, and I hope he doesn't mind me quoting. He said that our winemaker had made some of the best Cabernet Sauvignon he had tasted on the East Coast. And I think a lot of that is doing things the right way. We're not a tasting room. We're an estate winery. And what that means is we make, produce, and bottle things on site here. And that makes a difference. There's a lot of folks that can do things a different way. That's a route we had always strived to be at because we can do different techniques like delissage. I'll be brief. Delissage is where we do whole berry presses and whole berry fermentation. We bought this machine, and no joke, it's from Italy. It's called the Dream Machine. And instead of being a crusher to stemmer, it shakes the grapes off, the stems. So you can do a press or go straight into the tanks. We do basically gravity flow without having to build an elaborate contraption. We go straight from the Dream Machine. It sorts the grapes by size. It gets rid of all the trash and the leaves. It's just really a neat, and I'm sure other companies make them. I think Prospero actually made this machine. We're not plugging for them, but it's a good way because a lot of people don't sort their grapes. And if you don't get grapes, the biggest thing that I've heard a lot of folks comment about the wines here is the vegetative taste, the pyrazine. So when we choose yeast and when we choose how we pick and drop grapes, we try and get our fruit as ripe as we can. And we really try and separate in the vineyard as well as mechanically.
Yeah, you want to get those green berries out of there.
You don't want any vegetative or unripe fruit or fruit that's got rot in it because it's kind of like one bad apple spoils the whole bunch. Well, it's very true with grapes, even more so. And being able to get those grapes out and into a tank. But back to the delissage, I'm left-handed. You'll have to excuse me. So open up a lot of windows. I'll try and close them all. But when you put those grapes in the tank, the red grapes to ferment, you have to do a punch down. And you can cancel your membership at the gym because punching down is very hard, especially in a 1,000-gallon tank. And you have to be careful not to scratch the sides of the tanks. We've got a lighter push down. So we did that for a while, and then we learned about this technique called delissage, where you take the free wine that's underneath those grapes and you pump it over into another tank that aerates all that CO2 and all the other bad stuff that shouldn't be in there comes off. And then your grapes are down at the bottom, the actual grapes, and you put the wine on top of it. I'm talking with my hands. I know people can't see this, but those grapes have to float up through the wine again. So that's the best way to extract colors and flavors from the skins when you're trying to get that contact.
It's a nice gentle way of doing it too.
It's a much gentler. We don't have a must pump. That's not a must for us. There's no must pump here.
So one of the things you talked about earlier was about the research part of it and how it's difficult to find out because overall, North Carolina, the industry is pretty young, so we're still figuring out what's really growing well. So in this part of North Carolina, what grows well for you?
Well, I'll give you a little bit of pre that. We probably drove Tony Wolf crazy, who was a professor at Virginia Tech. He finally said, "You boys aren't even from North Carolina." He said, "I don't know why I keep taking your calls." So we were very persistent in what was going on with Virginia. Virginia, to be honest with you, is a little few years ahead of us.
Yeah, they are.
And I don't know if it's because of the Goldie funds. You know, that was Philip Morris versus Winston or R.J. Reynolds. So they have no idea why they're a little bit ahead of us or what their university did.
They had a little earlier start, too. So
Mid-70s
is when things first started kicking off there. Yeah. So versus really it was like late 90s, early 2000s here.
Bottom line is we wore out Dr. Wolf. And we asked about elevations, and he said, "You guys are just going to basically have to
figure it out.
And we looked at what people were doing in different regions of the world because California is different than
us. Of course.
They don't have the humidities and things we have to deal with. But being at a higher elevation here, we have less humidity and chance for rot and the fungus and things that are common in some areas. So we just took the chance, you know, we put up our money and we took our chances. So the research was looking at where apples had been able to grow because apples don't get the same diseases but have a lot of the same problems. So we kind of had a guinea pig, so to speak, with the apples. Hmm. And then we looked at what Burgundy would grow in other regions that were similar to us. You know, we have a lot of rain here. We have late frost here. And then we'll have a rainy season. You know, when we get to hurricane season, we might catch some of those rains, not necessarily the wind or the hurricane, but we'll get some of the remnants of that. So we had to look at, you know, when things would get ready, when they'd be ripe. Obviously, the white grapes come in earlier than the reds. So we just honestly started looking at what we liked to drink and what people were drinking, and tried our best to see what clones that we could get. Clones would be the top part of the grape. The rootstock would be a different clone as well. So we tried to see what combination that would work here, because they make, it's about like shoes. The roots are, you can get roots that grow deep, that are made for dry weather, wet weather, different types of soil. So it was really, that was the biggest study we had to do. And I did have some help from my first partner. He did a lot of research on that, as well as we just asked questions, like I said.
It's a fun analogy with the shoes. I think that's the first time I've heard of that. So that's kind of fun.
Yeah, makes sense though.
Yeah, definitely.
Got to have good shoes in the grape industry with those roots. Some of those roots will go down 10, 15 feet. So we don't irrigate here. You know, when we get young plants, if we have a dry season, we have to water by machine, but we don't set up irrigation. It's pretty tough as cold as it gets here. You break, we try and rotivate the rows to where we don't let the roots get intertwined. We did study a lot about different trellis systems. Nobody that's worked for me yet really enjoys the Geneva double curtain, which is the grapes are up high, not down low, like the vertical shoot positioning. So we still are trying different trellis systems, and we'll continue to. If I did what everybody asked me to do, everybody would probably get along, but you just don't make progress for either side. I learned what is impossible. And if we can't get around that, then, you know, I'll raise my hand, but I'm not afraid to take that chance. I think that not taking a chance is the biggest chance you take, if that makes any sense.
What would you say is like the, Is there an overriding style of the wine then that you get from these grapes, or is it just depend on what the variety is?
It depends on the variety, but we really tend to go the French techniques and styles with our winemaking, whether it's the yeast, the delissage, even with some of the whites. We know the whites that can handle some skin contact. Give you a quick example. We've never done this before. Tim Crow is our winemaker, and we're very proud to have Tim here. He's got over 30 years experience all over the world and all over the U.S. as well. And Tim is not afraid to tell you his opinion like most winemakers. But I'm in there with him arguing this stuff out. We just want the best answer. But he did some skin contact with Vidal, and he really has a Vidal he made for lack of a better word. We have these cleaning vessels over there that are basically look like large Tupperware trash cans that are different colors that we have chemicals in. He made a batch of Vidal with skin contact, and it tastes almost like a Pinot Grigio. I mean, it was just surprising how it kind of took some of the more acidic flavors away and softened it, but really increased the range of the palate. And so we did that in 1,000 gallons. We did it for real. And we try and process. I remember when this year Tim started dropping fruit. And dropping fruit means you're cutting back your yield, but you're really improving your yield because what you get is ripe and it's good. And I'm coming out there. I'm about to have a stroke. Like, Tim, what are you doing?
There's no grapes left.
Didn't we pay you your paycheck? Your paycheck, not cash. But Tim has helped us understand how to make not just volume wine, but how to make your wines as best they can be made. I'm not going to be pious and tell you we make excellent wine. more so than anybody around us. Our goal is just to make the best wine that we can. We're in competition with ourselves. And the biggest judge of that is going to be the folks that purchase our wine, our customers, more so than it is the awards we win. When we enter contests, we enter really to get feedback for the wine, from the judge to the winemaker. And we'll enter things that sometimes we don't even display the awards. Some of them are international awards. But it's that feedback you get from somebody that's going to tell you the truth. And I'll tell you, one judge they should have is Ian Taplin, because Ian Taplin is brutal to me with that English accent. So, Alan, come just a moment here. And Ian will take it to his friends in California, as well as some of his friends down in Winston. And I just wait to get back. And it's nice. Occasionally, Ian said, "Oh, you an apology, Alan." Said, some of my friends said that they would buy this just as much as they would have bought a wine from the West Coast. And, I have to kind of punch him a little bit on that. But
that accent, he makes it sound nice no matter what the news is.
He does. He puts it away. Ian's really one of the diamonds in the rough here, in my opinion, that he tells it like it is. He looks at the trends in wine, which we see for that next generation, what people like. Where I might like that deep, bold, dark red and blah, blah, blah. We were one of the first people to do sparkling wines in the state. Now everybody's doing them, which is great, but that competition just makes you have to go to that next level. And some of those spirits or semi-spirits, however they ultimately classify that, I'm not going to get into TTB issues because I don't want to visit, but we're trying to do some higher alcohol, lower alcohol brandies because we grow a lot of things here. We grow apples, we grow peaches, we grow blackberries, we grow plums, nectarines. So there's a lot of fruit here that we can make the wine out of, and then you can distill that down. You don't have to go up to the spirit level, but you can make it into a higher alcohol. We do no grains or anything like that, but we've ordered a cognac still from Cognac France because those types of stills really help keep the flavors in whatever you're doing at whatever alcohol level you do. So
we're actually at a pretty good spot to take a quick little education segment break, but when we come back, let's talk a little bit more about the wines, the spirits, the ciders, the different things you have to offer here. It's time again for Wine Class with the Wine Mouths. Jesse and Jessica, welcome back.
Thanks.
So we're talking styles of wine this year. So what style of wine are we talking about today?
So today we have another example of old things becoming new again. So we are drinking a Paquette.
All right. Well, tell us more.
So a Paquette is a wine style. It's very easy drinking, slightly effervescent, and it has a lower alcohol content. So you can kind of compare it to a session beer. It's like a 4-9% alcohol content wine style.
All right.
So old traditions, this Paquette is obviously a French word. So it was historically enjoyed by French farmhands and vineyard workers. It's a wine. We call it a wine style. But I guess if you wanted to be super technical, it's not technically a wine because it's not made from fermented grapes. It is made by adding water to the grape pomace, which the pomace is the leftover skins and seeds and stem after you make the wine, and fermenting kind of just what's left over. So you're getting a second go at your waste from making wine.
Oh, good way to kind of reuse some things.
Yeah.
Stretch it out.
For sure. Yeah, and so this can be made from any number of grapes and just really in any style, and different things can be used to reuse that byproduct. But the history of Paquette, it comes from the French word for prick or prickle, and that is due to the drink's slight fizz, that effervescence on your tongue. And while the style is tied closely to France, nearly all European winemaking countries have their own version of Paquette. And it was usually made and consumed by field workers and their families. because I'm guessing it was a lot easier to get back to work after lunch if you are taking a break from your manual labor and you're drinking, you know, something that's very low alcohol versus, ooh, you know, it'd be harder to get back out.
I can see that.
Yeah.
And, you know, it might just be easy to, like, I'll take some of those crushed up grapes and take them home.
Yeah, yeah, we don't want them. They're no good to us. And Piquette actually also dates back to ancient Greek and Roman times. And in Roman times, it was known as Laura, L-O-R-A. And this was a really thin, bitter wine and commonly drunk by not just, like, you know, farmhands and stuff, but also Roman slaves. And at this time in history, and throughout much of it, the ancient world at this time, sweet white wines were actually the most desirable style. So these thin, bitter wines would have been really, you know, not desirable. Of course, I don't really trust their taste because back then they were also drinking wine that was diluted with warm water and sometimes even seawater. So, no thanks.
That whole lead thing, too. Just like sweet
metals. They didn't have the greatest taste. So it was just really considered a cheap drink made from the scraps of winemaking. And then the scraps of the scraps were given to farm animals, like, you know, farm animals to eat the scraps. So once all that wine.
Lamb eating this stuff.
Yeah, gotta have a tie-in. Right. So you have all these leftovers that you make a second thing from, and then those leftovers have another life. So, but just as an example, so in Italy, Piquette also has various names. So it can, you know, goes back to the history and how it wasn't just in France. It's all over.
So how's it made? We kind of talked on this a little bit, that it's the byproduct of winemaking. But you can use any grapes, any style of wine, right? Because it's just the grape skins that are left over. So any different variety, you can have a Piquette from that variety. And it's made by adding water to the grape skins and seeds that have been pressed. And then they're pressed again for a second pressing. And that's kind of how and why it's a lower alcohol content, because it's kind of the second pass at pulling out the sugars and everything to convert to alcohol. But there's also some challenges with it. So, you know, this is an old style that I don't think anybody decided, like, hey, I'm going to do this and make it something cool and make it a style. But now that's what we're doing, right? So now it's like, let's take this and make it something hip and cool. But so we're hitting some issues. Bacterial infections can occur easily because it's lower alcohol content. So wine is usually safe, right? Because it's such a high alcohol content, bacteria and stuff's not going to live in that environment. But because we're lowering the alcohol, you have to be extra careful for bacteria and different things with the wine. Especially lactic acid can be one of the ones that you have to keep an eye out for. A lot of times modern winemakers will add some wine back into the tank when they're making a Piquette because of these issues with the different bacterias. So they're not just doing it as a byproduct. They're adding some wine to help with that. They can also introduce honey or sugar before to add more for the fermentation.
Kind of help it out.
And often like a wild yeast and just kind of what happens.
Right. Yeah. And then that second fermentation is kind of how we have that spritziness. That's where that comes from, is that it's fermenting again because we're adding, you know, water back to the seeds and skins that may have some sugar left over.
A lot of things just naturally happen. Mm-hmm. It's like, okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So what are we drinking now?
All right. So today we have some Piquette from Nomad, which is in High Point.
Mm-hmm.
And we learned that it is a blend of, let me get these right, Syrah, and Muscat.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. And so what would you guys share about this?
So sometimes for me, Piquette is not, doesn't pack a punch as far as flavor because it's, you know, it's the second press. Mm-hmm. It's the, but I think this one actually has decent mm-hmm. amounts of flavor. Mm-hmm. I would say there's some cherry probably would be the predominant fruit mm-hmm. I would get.
Yeah. You do have some of that sparkle effervescence mm-hmm. kind of sip it because it had that little nice little dancing.
Yeah, kind of prickles the tongue a little mm-hmm. bit.
Yeah. And I hate everybody can't see the color, but it is a beautiful pink.
Yeah.
Yeah, almost fuchsia.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cherry's a good descriptor because I feel like I could see
it. Yeah, it kind of looks like cherry, doesn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, almost like cherry juice.
With some little bubbles on top.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. So in general, Piquettes are usually generally dry and a bit bubbly, of course. But it really depends on what grapes are going into it and what how that translates. Yeah, this one's just like a nice, easy drinking.
Yeah.
Compare well with anything.
Yeah, it's almost like a rosé. Mm-hmm. But it still has like some of those, like you feel that structural tannin.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so are we ready to talk about pairings?
Sure. Yeah, let's go for it.
So I would say that a salad of some sort with probably some strawberries and feta and that sort of thing might be a good pairing. I would also think maybe some sort of pork chop, pork loin would be a good pairing with this, particularly if there's like some sort of cherry glaze or demi-glace or something like that.
I was totally thinking like Baja fish tacos.
Ooh. Yeah,
yeah,
that could be good. Yeah,
that sounds great. I was thinking like fried chicken, like hot chicken, Nashville style, and like the spiciness. I think,
be a nice lunchtime wine as well because it is lighter.
Absolutely,
it's just like refreshing. It's you don't have to.
I mean, you can have it with a sandwich.
Yeah,
you know, too. Yeah. So.
I mean, why limit yourself to lunch? There's also breakfast.
true. Like some pancakes with some cherries on top. Yeah. I mean, so
that sounds great.
I can actually even see this with like a bagel with lox and cream cheese.
Or like a BLT with some pimento cheese on it.
Yeah.
The pimento cheese has got a little bit of spice.
Mm-hmm. Like a cherry granola situation.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. That would be good.
Dried cherries. I don't know. Could go a lot of ways with this.
This would also be a good wine for, like, if you found it anywhere that was canned, like kind of adventure, you know, if you want it out on the beach or something.
So Fireclay Cellars does some of their piquettes in cans. So they have a recently, well, last year, I think they had a Chamberson and a Treminet. Both were super excellent. And there's Plebe, I think, has done some piquettes before. Mm-hmm. Botanist and Barrel, I think, has done some piquettes.
Yeah.
There are several options around the state, and you're seeing more and more. And there's probably several others that... Plebe, I believe, has tried piquettes as well. So there's, and then there's probably others around the state that are maybe thinking about doing it. I think it's a great way, again, to reuse something you already have. It's probably a cheaper product to produce because you already have the pumice.
It's a nice little side project.
Yeah.
Yeah.
To
Definitely.
Something to do. Happens, play around.
Exactly.
Yeah. And it'd be a good starting point for people, too, maybe if they weren't wine drinkers or they or wanted something more. Are, cocktail-like or juice-like.
It's almost like a sour beer, too. It's like got that kind of funk.
Oh, with like the low-alcohol movement as well. I mean, it's a wine still, and it's lower alcohol. So it'd be kind of like wine adjacent.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
So try some.
Everybody should head to Nomad Wine Works in High Point. That's what we're drinking now. It's really lovely.
And if you like learning about French terms, then you'll love our class through Davidson Davie Community College this spring, starting in April. We're going to be teaching a 4-week class on like an introduction to French wines and regions and history and all that. April 2nd through 23rd, we'll be meeting at different wineries in Davidson County. You can find out more information on our website, which is winemouth.com.
Yeah. Come learn more with us.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, Jesse and Jessica, this has been great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You can find out more information about the Wine Mouths by going to their website, winemouths.com, or on Facebook and Instagram at Wine Mouths. That's WineMouths. And now, back to the show.
So we're back with Alan Ward. So Alan, where we last left off, you were talking a little bit about some of those spirit-like products that you make here, but let's also talk about just all the things that you're producing.
Well, the first thing that pays the bills and keeps us going to be sustainable are the wines. And, you know, different times of the year, the whites sell. And it seems like in the colder times of the year, the reds sell more. And we do some fun things as well as some serious things. My favorites are, we've got one wine in particular, that's a Bordeaux blend. It was named, we try and name our wines after family or place. It's Jasper. And Jasper was a Bordeaux blend, Cabernet Sauvignon, Cabernet Franc, Merlot, Petit Verdot, and Malbec. And the Malbec we did have to buy from, because we're not producing that here. But that wine we aged in French oak. We only use French oak. And, That was really one of my favorite because it had such a broad spectrum. It had been aged for two and a half years in oak. And you go through a fermentation It's not that you want the oak taste. The oak's there to help you extract some of the flavors as well as get rid of some of the things you don't want. But you go through a second fermentation, and that's really tricky. It's called malic fermentation or malactic acid. So you're trying to take the malactic acid. The best way I could explain it, it's like a triangle. When you go through malactic fermentation, you take malic acid and convert it to lactic. So that's where you get that buttery taste, whether it's a Chardonnay or in a red wine. It's where you take that malic and turn it into lactic. So think about butter, you know, as lactic if you're lactose intolerant. So it's not got anything to do with milk and butter, but that's the flavonoid in there. Yeah. So that really smooths, and it's like taking a square and just cutting the edges off and making it rounder and to where you can taste the other things and not just have it just totally harsh on the reds. So the Petit Verdot does the second wine I would have to say that I really enjoy. One wine that we were very surprised at, we ozonated, used ozone to kill the native yeast on it inside of a cooler, was a Norton. Stephen Rigby had made a Norton for us, just a straight Norton. And we had several people taste it, and it tasted more like an Italian varietal. A Norton has a very strong characteristic, and a lot of color, so a lot of people use it to blend with. And I've heard everybody claim that it came from here, it came from there. I don't think that anybody really knows where Norton came from.
It just kind of appeared in our lives, so we're thankful for that.
Yeah, and it's a native root stock, so you don't have to worry so much about that. Sometimes you may want to graft it to a different root stock, depending on what your needs are. But Chamberson is a French hybrid that we enjoy too. But Cab Franc, Cabernet Sauvignon, and those blends are really where I really enjoy those wines. And we'll do some rosés, but we do one called Nouveau Jour. It's kind of a Beaujolais style where it's the first press, and it would go through malic, but it's if you guys get a chance, I think we have some left. Barbara probably put up for you, but we sold out of it. But it was a very light red wine. It was like if you were red wine drinker and you didn't drink whites, if you're a white wine drinker and don't drink reds, this is kind of in between without being a rosé. I mean, it was rosé plus, let's say. Nice. And they tell me Beaujolais style, so I don't really know what that means. That's just what Barber winds me up and sends me out into the world to say. But it was very delightful because it would be something you could have with light food as well as just enjoy alone. As far as the whites go, Viognier is really something I enjoy. A lot of people hate to grow Viognier. Viognier is like that little pinnacle. You get it where it's not ripe, or you get it where it's too ripe and it's just alcohol. But if you can find that Viognier and get it just right, it really makes, to me, a very enjoyable wine. So we do have, a great Viognier that we'll bottle here in the next probably month or so. I'm really impressed with what Tim's done with the Vidal Blanc, which is a good grape to grow here. But we'll drop some of it because it's so vigorous, where we can really get some of those rich flavors in there that you sometimes don't get in a grape that's very vigorous. And we do that in the pruning as well as in the thinning. Chardonnay is fine. You may like a good Chardonnay, a great Chardonnay. We do a dry Riesling, and we had won some good awards overseas for a Riesling we did a few years ago that was zero residual. It's very dry. You don't think of a Riesling being dry. But then we've got people that like a kind of in between. We don't really do a sweet wine, but the rosé is another wine that we did this year. We do a sparkling rosé. This is the first year we didn't do a sparkling rosé. We're just way behind over here and didn't have all our equipment set up. We regret that. Our barber still gives me a hard time about that today. So it's like asking me which of my children I enjoy.
Yeah.
I love them all. But experimenting with Petit Mansang,
oh, nice.
Again, a lot of it's just like flour, milk, and butter. It's what you do with it. My mom likes the cooking shows. I don't. I've watched them with her. She's 93. But a lot of it is how you can take something that traditionally is labeled here, whether it's a Riesling, Petit Mansang, any of these varietals, and really experiment with a little bit of blending. It might be 3%, 2%, 10%, and it just changes the whole characteristic and really just enhances and makes it congruent with the flavors. We'll continue to do that. I really get involved with the when we're doing the trials. I mean, our number one goal is to have no wine faults. We would rather distill it or drain it if something's not right. And you know that pretty early on if you've got a problem in a wine. And we've been very lucky. I'm going to verify this is real wood I'm knocking on. But we've been lucky there. But that's only getting you halfway there. That's like getting into college. You've got to, you know, wanting to go to med school, you got to make the grades and pass the MCAT. So what we try and do next is really take that wine and figure out what we're trying to get out of it, what flavors with the yeast, and that's Tim's job. My favorite wine that we don't grow here at this time, but we have a vineyard that we just leased that does have, is a grape that's really known from New Zealand. And Sauvignon Blanc is one of my favorite wines. I know that that pungent aroma you get from it is just something we're trying our best to pull out of some of the whites that are in that category. And this will be the first year that we'll have access to Sauvignon Blanc and see what we can do with it. I think so. And we're not going to, you know, make 50,000 different wines, but it's kind of neat to come in with some of the smaller batches to let people taste and see and experiment. And we're starting our tours out in the big building. We fix it up to where we can do really not bakey, you know, tasting. I don't know how to put that, but where people can come out and really get an idea how wine's produced, what it takes, talks to the winemaker without it sounding like we're Chateau Ward, we're St. Paul Mountain Vineyards.
Yeah, you got to keep it at a level people can understand.
Well, we want people necessarily that honestly is our has always been our goal. A lot of people are very uncomfortable with wine. Yeah. And think you got to have your tuxedo on and all this knowledge. And it's just what you enjoy. We get people from all levels of life and, you know, from all over the country. And we make one wine where we put, it's called Ben Chocolate the Barista. That's kind of a fun wine. I remember the first time we had some folks in from the West Coast and they wanted to taste the Ben Chocolate the Barista. It's where we take a good red wine or a great red wine. We don't try not to do good. We try to do great, but we take a great red wine. We take two extracts, cacao, a chocolate extract, and a coffee extract from a coffee bean. They're extracts, not artificial flavors. So we have to get all this TTB approval to do this stuff. So, and it's got to be the perfect blend to give you just this rich wine that's kind of a, I'd call almost call it a cognac substitute at low alcohol levels. But I don't know if you guys have ever tried the Ben Chocolate Barista.
Yeah. We enjoyed it.
And it's a fun wine.
Yeah, it is.
And we tell people when we do the tastings, I said, if you talk, we're going to charge you an extra $20. I said, we want you to do the swirl. And you guys know I'm the swirl guy. And trying to get them to get the most out of that wine and just at the end. But anyway, back to the California people. When they come in, I headed out the door. I thought they would laugh us out of the building, but they wound up buying a couple of cases because it was just unique.
Yeah.
And now when we go with Ian out to the West Coast, when he allows us to, I feel like the Beverly Hillbillies when he loads us up. We got Ian out there. He's Mr. Drysdale. And I guess I'm Jed Clampett. And we won't call Barb. We'll call Barbara Ellie Mae. But when we go out west, you're beginning to see where they're growing some different things because of climate change, regardless of what your thoughts are, as well as attitude changes in what people enjoy. We had one vineyard that met us at the door with a spritzer. And they were growing not a muscadine, but a muscat to make their spritzers out of. And that was just a little palate cleanser before you went in the door. And we learned from that. Yeah. Learned, you know, they're new things. And we've not even, we'll touch on the ciders real quick, if that's okay.
Yeah, yeah.
That, and I'll answer any questions to close up.
I'm just getting ready to move into the ciders. So.
So the ciders, we started out with old, you know, we've grown apples on this property really since the, gosh, the early 1900s. And the people that grew the apples here really were very hardy and very smart, didn't have any money. And come up through the, I guess, the 20s and the Depression era, these people had to be smart to make apples work here because they didn't have the money and they just used their smarts and were very, very good. At one time, we were the fifth largest apple producer in the nation, Henderson County.
Right.
As a, you know, our state, but Henderson County was fifth. And things changed where apples became a commodity and Honeycrisp and all this stuff. But we kept some of the old Stamen wine sap apples, Jonathan's, John of Gold's, winter banana apples. Some of those had tannin and they were old school apples, but they still weren't true cider variety apples.
Right.
And we don't have anything against the grocery store canned ciders. The only thing we put in a can is our beans or get out of a can of beans. We have everything in glass. We're just kind of anal about that in that we're really trying to bring that Normandy quality of ciders to the state. And we've been lucky in doing that in that with a couple of battles with the USDA in bringing trees here from France mainly, but Spain and a few from the UK. So you've got three distinct European cider styles. In Spain, they throw cider. It's unfiltered, and it's just a different concept. Looks about like orange juice. And the UK, they'll sweat the apples and do these things, and they have, to me, a kind of a blander cider. And then there's the French, who really make a cider because cider is a wine.
It is.
And so we, when we pick our apples, we don't sweat them. We pick them. And we try and press them as soon as we get them to where we don't start oxidation or anything setting up. The same with the, we do with grapes, you know, the sooner you get them to the press and cool them down, less oxidation you're going to have and the less, you know, the fermentation start on its own with the wild yeast or the yeast that are on the apples or the grapes. So we've got right now, I think 14 different varieties of French apples here. And about three Spanish and about four UK styles. And we call that cider Wallace. Wallace was my dog. That was the original name. And then when we opened up a cider, before we had the cider, we decided to call it Appalachian Ridge and name some of the other ciders after the different mountain range. But we're kind of tending to go back toward the Wallace label and the because we're, as we grow, as you guys can see up here, we've got all those apples that are on trellis are European-style apples. So we're trying to give the apples as much tannin variety as we do in the wines. Cider is like, you know, being naked in front of a window, and that's probably not a great analogy for your podcast, folks. You can't hide a wine fault in a cider. I mean, it comes out every time. We've been very lucky, again, knocking on wood, to have people like Stephen Rigby that really helped us pioneer. Some folks thought we were crazy for doing the ciders, but we were the first to do the ciders in this part of the state. And our ciders are clear, as you've seen. We do them just like the we do the ciders just like we do the grapes and spend as much time on them. We'll put some of the ciders in barrel. And then our ciders, all of them, we do have some level of carbonation.
Okay. There. That was going to be my next question. Yeah. I thought that was
we
the do. Case.
But... We use a bright tank.
Yeah.
We've tried doing it the old way, and it's not like champagne grapes,
right.
Like Chardonnay. Or, you know, you can explode some bottles and some people who's trying to do that in the bottle. You don't want to do that. We did it by accident one time when not here, but we had one batch where it was just like we had to uncap all those and distill it. But that somehow yeast had either gotten the line, and the bottles were like, you know, they were, you could see the bubbles and were like, that's not good at all. And you'd open up the bottle and half of it wind up on the ceiling or all over you. So we've learned over the years, you know, if you don't make mistakes, you can't learn what not to do again. But we've been very happy with our cider production. And cider is something that we can put, and we're starting to do this with some of the white wines, in a keg, because you can save on the glass, the labels. And we're even thinking about going to reusable bottles, like when I was a kid, probably twice you guys' age. But
no, you're not twice.
Used to pick up Coca-Cola bottles.
You have to be your mother's age. It's been twice.
But we're looking at having our bottles embossed, and if we can even recycle 60% of the bottles to get them back, that'll be a good savings.
Yeah.
And then it saves us from the label. You know, and people, I think, appreciate that, because when you recycle glass in the dumpster out here, the majority of it doesn't get recycled.
Right.
Because they have to take the color out of the bottle and all this stuff. So we've looked at that, and there's a neat company, and I think they're in Wisconsin. They've made bottle washers for years where we would, you know, guarantee our clients that anything that we do recycle is thoroughly cleaned. No different than when we were kids, what they used to do with Coke bottles.
Right.
You'll notice in Maine and some states, when you buy glass, it'll say you've got to put a deposit down. So we think that's a good marketing strategy, in that it gets people's attention, that understand you're trying to be, you know, not just frugal from that aspect, but you're trying to be economically and ecologically, you know, a good steward.
Yeah.
And we hate seeing that, because we know glass doesn't disintegrate in the landfill, and it's just a waste. It's just a total waste.
Yeah.
And so that's another project that we've got coming down. The last project we've got, and I'll let you get back in control here of your own show, is we have two folks we're talking about or talking with to put in a small restaurant here. That's some local kids that have really worked really hard at what they've done, and been very successful, to where we'll have some food here that's on site that they can help with a lot of the pairings. And that we'll take our food truck, which I don't like being in the food business. And, you know, we like, and we'll still have other food trucks come, the lobster truck and different things people like. But we'll be able to take our little food truck and go down in the meadow, out in the orchard when the apples are in bloom or when the apples are really pretty, and just do some things and let people have different experiences. So back to your podcast.
Very nice. Very nice. So besides all of that, is there anything else that you're looking forward to as you continue to grow the brands at St. Paul Farms?
We are in that we've got Barbara right now. She's on the coast. She's out on Emerald Isle. We have an isle and a house out there on Emerald Isle. And we've been to a few festivals out there. So we're probably going to open up, not probably, we are going to open up a tasting room on the coast.
Cool. And I think Barbara has mentioned that to us.
So. A lot of people want the dry wines, and they're not able to maybe get them there. Our overhead's here. So Barbara and her daughter lives on the island as well. So we're hoping that will be a good way to spread across the We're trying to find ways to stay out of it. We don't have anything against distributors. Another thing that we're working with is we talked about kegging. If you think about a white wine, if you're a restaurant owner, if you can get a keg of wine where you open up a bottle and you have to pour it out if you get one glass out of it, nobody else finds it. But we're going to start having restaurant owners, local restaurant owners, not change, but local restaurant owners. And we're lucky to be in some pretty large places in Charlotte. with some of our products, but we're going to have them come out and taste our wines. And we don't have a problem introducing them to other people in the region that make their wines here. To where you're going to go local, we're kind of putting it back on them. We send you clients, customers, that you need to have a great local wine. And if they taste the wine and it is what we feel is a wine that would be competing with anything that they're serving, foreign or domestic, that we hope that that'll be another outlet for our wine, but mainly to get people from that restaurant and from the different restaurants in the region to come back here. So that's another project that we're on. And we'd encourage other people in different parts of the state to do the same thing. It's trying to find a way to get it into a restaurant versus just going distributing where you have to do mass production.
Yeah. I think you have a lot of, you're in a good location because you have Hendersonville literally minutes from where we're sitting right now. And they have a lot of great restaurants there. So a lot of them are local food, too. So it's a great thing to
Asheville, we have to work with the state laws across the line in Greenville. Most of our, you know, the wineries in the state bring in a lot of what they call heads and beds. And their multiplier effect for every dollar that they bring in really goes a long ways, especially if you're making your own wines here with the people you employ and the volumes you're able to produce and control. But when we get people that come here from out of state, we spent the money for the interstate signs. That was a big, big plus for us. Get people off the interstate and come because, you know, you get this kind of attitude about wines where, well, you know, it's from here, it's not great, or it's not great there. But we can make, in my opinion, not just us, but in North Carolina, we can make wines that rival anybody. I really feel that because of the soils and taking the time and the techniques that we use. And it's like anything else. We are new in the wine world, but you learn from the people and you have the right folks like Tim and other winemakers in our state. I wish that we did have a program where we really focused on the winemakers somewhat when we do some of our awards at the state level. And we had a program where we were able to, if we win something, we don't mind donating, let's say, $1,000 toward a scholarship for this winemaker or our winemaker or winemakers as a whole to further what education they choose or they feel that would be good.
Great idea.
It's just an idea. I mean, we just, when we raise the level of our quality in our state, I think everyone benefits.
People. For sure. Sure.
Yeah. And I know TripAdvisor, if you look on that, they had voted us as the number one winery in the state. And a lot of that was service. I didn't mention a lot about that, but I do want
to
get a pitch for Barbara and her staff because you can have the greatest wine in the world, but you've got to have the people that are able to explain and get people to taste and
that's
try.
That's what you're going to remember, and that's what's going to bring you back is that level of service.
Right.
Anything else you want customers to know about visiting St. Paul Mountain Vineyards and Appalachian Ridge?
We want them to know where we are.
Yes, let's tell them that.
If you Google St. Paul Farms, you know, we don't have exotic websites, but if you Google St. Paul Farms, it will take you to our website. And there's some videos on there. North Carolina Public Television did a good little segment on us, and they do it on different wineries, different times of the year. And the local television station, there's some good little videos there. It's just getting that word out. And I think once you come to a place like ours, as well as others in the county, that each person has their own little niche, maybe, or a differentiator. And it's not that one's better than the other. It's just they have different things.
Yeah.
And we're trying a lot of different things. We're not just throwing it up on the wall.
Right.
We're doing a crème. That's the last thing I'll mention, where we figured out how you can blend the brandy-like alcohol with a cream. And again, this is another TTB probe there, but not probe, but exercise. We had some stuff that's called crème that we brought back from Normandy. The alcohol level is probably 15-16%, but it is just It's just amazing. They told us kind of that magic formula you use to keep it from, to where it's homogenous, where it doesn't separate. So it's where you'll blend some brandy with some cider and some cream. Mm. And it's really quite neat. And I'm not big on that kind of stuff, but I really enjoyed that. So we're trying to go back to the future, as you would say.
Well, it's fun. Every time we come, there's always something different, something else you're trying. So it's great to see that you're willing to take a few risks and try some things, bring in the apples from Normandy and UK and Spain, and then what you're trying to do in the winery with having the production facility. So it's really awesome. So.
Well, again, we appreciate you guys taking time to come out. My last comment would be for the state, for people to really take the time to learn about farm preservation, because if we don't have the land, we can't expand. I guess that rhymes.
That's right. Yeah.
Thanks very much for your time.
We appreciate it.
That's it for this episode of Cork Talk.
Thanks again to Alan. The conversation was wonderful, and we could have talked for another hour or more. We highly recommend that everyone plan a visit today.
If you like this episode, be sure to subscribe to the podcast and leave us a rating and review. It helps others find Cork Talk and lets us know how we can improve.
And don't forget to follow us on social media. You can find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Threads at NC Wine Guys. Until next time, and remember, a cork only talks when it's out of the bottle. Cheers.
Cork Talk is a Freeman LLC production.
This episode was made possible in part by a grant from the North Carolina Wine and Grape Council.
Pour a glass of your favorite North Carolina wine, mead, or cider and enjoy all that North Carolina wine country has to offer. To plan your trip, download the NC Wine app or visit ncwine.org.